The contrary influences to which he has been exposed may cause a tempest to rage through his heart, but when he has gained the power to command the tempest to cease and to say to the excited waves, "Be still," then will the first gleam of the rising sun appear in his heart, and before its warm glow the cold moonlight thrown out by the calculating and reflecting brain will grow pale, a new and still larger world than the external one will appear before his interior vision, in which he will be contented to live, and where he will find an inexhaustible source of happiness, unknown to those who live a life of the senses. Henceforth he will require no more to speculate reflectively about the truth, for he will see it clear in his own heart. Henceforth he will not be required to be exposed to storms, but may seek shelter in a tranquil place, not because he is afraid of the storms, which can do him no harm, but because he wants to employ his energies for the full development of the newly awakened spiritual germ, instead of wasting them uselessly on the outward plane. What the disciple ought to seek is to strengthen his character, which constitutes his real individuality, keeping it always in harmony with the law of divine wisdom and love. A man without strength of character is without true individuality, without self, reliance, moved only by the emotions which arise in his mind and which belong to powers foreign to his divine nature. Only after the attainment of a certain state of maturity, life in a solitude, isolated from contrary influences, becomes desirable and useful, and those who retire from the world as long as they need the world are attempting to ascend to the kingdom of heaven by beginning at the top of the ladder. Let him who needs the world remain in the world. The greater the temptations by which he is surrounded, the greater will be his strength if he successfully resists. Only he who can control his mind and within his own mental sphere create the conditions which his spirit requires, is independent of all external conditions and free. He who cannot evolve a world within his own soul needs the external world to evolve his soul. Unspiritual men, therefore, who retire from the world because they are afraid of the world, cannot be considered to be heroes who have renounced the world. They deserve rather to be regarded as cowards who have deserted their ranks at the beginning of the battle with life. Such people sometimes retire into convents for the purpose of having a comfortable life, and in addition to that a ticket to heaven. They imagine they do a service to God by leading a harmless and useless life, for which imaginary service they expect to obtain a reward at the end of life. But the reward which they will receive will also exist merely in their imagination. As the sensualist wastes his time in the prosecution of useless pleasures, so the bigot wastes his time in useless ceremonies and prayers. The actions of the former are instigated by a desire for sensual pleasure in this life, those of the latter by the hope for pleasure in another life. Both are acting for the purpose of gratifying their own selfish desires. I am unable to see any essential difference between the motives and morals of the two. But with spiritually developed man the case is entirely different. The divine spark in man exists independent of the conditions of relative space and time, it is eternal and self-existent. It cannot be angered by opposition, nor irritated by contradiction, nor be thrown into confusion by sophistry. If it has once become conscious of its own power, it will not require the stimulus needed by the physical organism and afforded by the impressions which come through the avenues of the senses from the outer world, for it is itself that stimulus which creates worlds within its own substance. It is the lord over all the animal elemental forces in the astral body of man, and their turmoil can neither educate nor degrade it, for it is divinity itself in its pure state, being eternal, unchangeable, and free. "Do you mean to say," I asked, "that all asceticism and self-denial is useless?" And the master answered, "It all depends upon the motive. All that the egotist does for his own selfish progress and aggrandizement is useless, it is done for an illusion, and increases his self-conceit. But this you will understand only when the consciousness of the divine state awakens within you, and you begin to realize the difference between your true and your elusive self. He in whom this divine principle has once awakened, he who has once practically experienced the inner life, who has visited the kingdom of heaven within his own soul, he who stands firm upon his feet, will no more need the educating influences of the contending storms of the outer world, to gain strength by resistance, nor will he experience any desire to return to the pleasures and tomfooleries of the world. He renounced nothing when he retired into the solitude, for it cannot be looked upon as an act of renunciation if we throw away a thing which is a burden to us. He cannot be called an ascetic, for he does not undergo any discipline or process of hardening. It is no act of self-denial to refuse things which we do not want. The true ascetic is he who lives in the world, surrounded by its temptations, he in whose soul the animal elements are still active, craving for the gratification of their desires and possessing the means for their gratification, but who by the superior power of his will conquers his animal self. Having attained that state, he may retire from the world and employ his energies for the employment and the further expansion of the spiritual power which he possesses. He will be perfectly happy, because that which he desires he can create in his own interior world. He expects no future reward in heaven, for what could heaven offer to him except happiness which he already possesses? He desires no other good but to create good for the world. If you could establish theosophical academies where intellectual and spiritual development would go hand in hand, where a new science could be taught, based upon a true knowledge of the fundamental laws of the universe, and where at the same time man would be taught how to obtain mastery over himself, you would confer the greatest possible benefit upon the world. Such a convent would, moreover, afford immense advantages for the advancement of intellectual research. The establishment of a number of such places of learning would dot the mental horizon of the world with stars of the first magnitude, from which rays of intellectual light would stream and penetrate the world. Standing upon a far higher plane than the material science of our times, a new and far greater field would be laid open for investigation and research in these centers. Knowing all the different opinions of the highest accepted authority, and not being bound by an orthodox scientific creed, having at their service all the results of the investigations of the learned, but not being bound to their systems by a belief in their infallibility, such people would be at liberty to think freely. Their convents would become centers of intelligence, illuminating the world, and if their power of self-control would grow in equal proportion with the development of their intellect, they would soon be able to enter adeptship. The adept had spoken these words with unusual warmth, as if he intended to appeal to my sympathy and to induce me to use my efforts to establish such convents. There was a look of pity in his eyes, as if he exceedingly regretted the state of poor ignorant humanity, with whose karma he was not permitted to interfere forcibly, according to the established rules of his order. I, too, regretted my own inability to establish such academies. And for once I wished that I were rich, so as to be able to make at least an attempt with one such establishment. But immediately the imperator saw my thought in my mind, and said, "You mistake, it is not the want of money which prevents us from executing this idea, it is the impossibility of finding at present the proper kind of people to inhabit the convent after it is established. Indeed, we would be poor alchemists if we could not produce gold in any desirable quantity, if some real benefit for humanity could be effected thereby, and of this I shall convince you, if you desire it. But gold is a curse to mankind, and we do not wish to increase the curse from which humanity suffers. Distribute gold among men, and you will only create a craving for more, give them power, and you will transform them into devils. No, it is not gold that we need, it is men who thirst after true wisdom. There are thousands who desire knowledge, but few who desire wisdom. Intellectual development, sagacity, craftiness, cunning, are too, they mistaken for spiritual development, but this conception is wrong. Animal cunning is not intelligence, craftiness is not wisdom, and most of your learned men are the last ones who can bear the truth. Even many of your would-be occultists and so, called Rosicrucians have taken up their investigations merely for the purpose of gratifying their idle curiosity, while others desire to pry into the secrets of nature to obtain knowledge which they hope to employ for the attainment of selfish ends. Give us men or women who desire nothing else but the truth, and we will take care of their needs. How much money will it require to lodge a person who cares nothing for comfort? What will it take to furnish the kitchen for those who have no desire for dainties? What libraries will be required for those who can read in the book of nature? What external pictures will please those who wish to avoid a life of the senses and to retire within their own selves? What terrestrial scenery shall be selected for those who live within the paradise of their souls? What company will please those who converse with their own higher self? How can we amuse those who live in the presence of God? Here the adept paused for a moment, and then continued, saying, "Verily the theosophical monastery of which I dream is even superior to ours. It is located far away from this earth, and yet it can be reached without trouble and without expense. Its monks and nuns have risen above the sphere of self. They have a temple of infinite dimensions, pervaded by the spirit of sanctity, which is the common possession of all. The differentiation of the universal soul ceases, and unification takes place. It is a convent where there exists no difference of sex, of taste, opinion, and desire, where vice cannot enter, where none are born, or marry, or die, but where they live like the angels, each one constituting the center of a powerful good, each one immersed in an infinite ocean of light, each one able to see all he desires to see, to know all he wants to know, growing in strength and expanding in size, until he embraces the all and is one with it." For a moment it seemed as if the soul of the adept had gone and visited that blissful state of nirvana, a state of which we mortals cannot conceive, but soon the light returned into his eyes, and he smilingly excused himself, saying that he had permitted himself to be carried away by the sublimity of this idea. I ventured to say that probably millions of ages would pass away before mankind would arrive at that state. "Alas," he answered, "the conditions which our present state of civilization imposes upon its followers are now such as to force the vast majority of humanity to employ nearly all their time and energy in an outward direction, instead of employing them for their inward growth. Each man has a certain amount of energy which he may call his own. If he wastes his energy on the outward plane, either for the attainment of sensual gratification or in intellectual pursuits, he will have nothing left to nourish the divine germ in his heart. If he continually concentrates his mind outwardly, there will be no inward concentration of thought, which is absolutely necessary for the attainment of self-knowledge. The laboring classes, men of commerce, scientists, doctors, lawyers, and clergymen are all actively engaged in outward affairs, and find little time for the inward concentration of their powers. The majority are continually occupied in running after shadows and illusions, which are at best only useful as long as they last, but whose usefulness ceases when the heart ceases to beat. Their time and energy are taken up in procuring what they call the necessaries of life, and they excuse themselves by saying that it is their misfortune to be so situated as to be forced to procure them. Nature, however, cares nothing for our excuses. The law of cause and effect is blind and inaccessible to argumentation. A man climbing over a mountain top and falling over a precipice is as much in danger of breaking his neck as if he had jumped down voluntarily. A man who is not able to progress will be left as far behind as one who does not desire to progress. But nature is not so cruel as she appears to be to the superficial observer. That which man requires for the purpose of living is very little indeed, and can usually be easily obtained, for nature has amply provided for all of her children, and if they cannot all obtain their proper share, then there must be something seriously wrong, either with them individually or with the social organization as a whole. There is undoubtedly a great deal wrong in our social organization, and our philosophers and politicians are continually trying to remedy it. They will succeed in their task when they succeed in making the laws of the human world harmonies with the laws of nature, and not before. That event may take place in the far distant future. We have not the time to wait for it. Let each one attempt to restore harmony in his own individual organism and live according to natural laws, and the harmony of the social organism as a whole will be restored." The words of the adept caused me some irritation, for I love the comforts of life. A spirit of contradiction arose within me and caused me to say, "Would you, Then, do away with all luxuries, which at our present stage of civilization have become necessities. Would you have us return to the semi-animal state of our forefathers, living as savages in the woods? I know there are certain cranks that harbor such views. Not so, answered the adept. The great bulk of those things which are said to be the necessities of life are only artificially created necessities, and millions of people lived and attained old age long before many of the things which our modern civilization considers as absolutely necessary had been discovered or invented. The term necessity has a relative meaning, and to a king a dozen of palaces, to a nobleman a carriage and four, may appear as much a necessity as to a beggar a bottle of whiskey, or to a fashionable man a new swallowtail coat. To get rid at once of all such fancied necessities and the trouble which is imposed upon us to attain them, the shortest and surest way is to rise above such necessities and to consider them not to be necessary at all. Then a great amount of our energy would become free, and might be employed for the acquisition of that which is really necessary, because it is eternal and permanent, while that which serves merely temporal purposes ends in time. There are thousands of people engaged in prying into the details of the constitution of external objects and in learning the chemical and physiological processes going on therein, and some are sacrificing their soul and extinguishing the spark of divinity within themselves by perpetrating the most inhuman cruelties upon their fellow beings for the purpose of gratifying their scientific curiosity and making useless discoveries for the promotion of their ambition, but they do not manifest the least desire to know their own real self, although it would seem that such a knowledge is far more important. Modern science says that she wants to know the laws of nature in all their minute ramifications, and yet she pays no attention whatever to the universal and fundamental law from which all these ramifications spring. And thus she resembles an insect crawling over a fallen leaf and imagining thereby to learn the qualities of the tree. It is surely the prerogative of intellectual man to investigate intellectually all the departments of nature, but the investigation of external things is only of secondary importance to the attainment of knowledge of our own interior powers. All primary powers act from within, effects are secondary to causes. He who considers the knowledge of external things to be more important than the knowledge of God, possesses very little wisdom indeed. God! I exclaimed. What can we know about God? How can you prove that such a being exists? To this answered the adept, I am sorry for a man who is so far backward in his course of spiritual evolution that he is not yet able to recognize the presence of God in everything. The Supreme Spirit which pervades, embraces, and penetrates everything, being the very essence, soul, and life of all things in the universe, from the atom up to the whole solar system, is beyond all mental conception. If he could be grasped by the human intellect, that intellect would have to be greater than God. There is nothing real but God. Nature itself is only a manifestation of his power. Let no man expect that somebody will prove to him the existence of God, but let everyone seek to be himself a living witness of his presence and power by becoming God, like and divine by his divine grace. Man is destined to restore within himself the divine image. When he realizes the divine ideal within his heart, his pilgrimage through manifold incarnations will have ended and the object of his existence be accomplished. Peace be with you. As the adept finished this sentence, a sound as if produced by the tinkling of small silver bells was heard in the air above our heads. I looked up, but nothing was to be seen from which that sound could have proceeded. This is the signal, said the adept, that the members of our order are assembled in the refectory. Let us go to join their company. Some refreshment will undoubtedly be welcome to you. Excerpt from With the Adepts, An Adventure Among the Rosicrucians. London, 1910. By Franz Hartmann. It would be too tedious to some of our readers if I were to report all the instructions that were given to me by my kind guide Theodorus, who, for all I know, may have been known as the celebrated Theophrastus Paracelsus during his life in the physical body. I do not, however, feel myself justified in omitting to tell what he said in regard to the importance of practicing self control and developing firmness of character and individuality. Previously to my visit to the Rosicrucian convent, I had been made to believe that occultism and mysticism were things only for dreamers, adapted to persons living continually in the clouds, enjoying their superstitions and vagaries by building castles in the air. But now, I found that self-reliance is a most necessary quality for a disciple of this sacred science, and that no science can be more exact than the one based upon our own exact spiritual knowledge and realized within our own soul. Thus Theodorus said, "A power to become strong at a center must be directed towards the center, for it is only by resistance that it can accumulate and become strong. A king who goes away from his kingdom and leaves it without protection may find other rulers there when he attempts to return. To become conquerors over nature, we must fight our own battles, and not wait until nature fights them for us. The more the animal elements within man's constitution are stimulated into life and activity by the temptations coming from the external world through the avenues of the senses, the hotter will be the battle, and the stronger will man's power grow if he successfully resists. This is the battle which the great Gautama Buddha fought and from which he came out victorious, because he was overshadowed by the Bo tree of wisdom. I will attempt to give you a rational explanation of the effects of inward concentration, to show you how you may become a creator of your own world. According to the teachings of the sages, the universal spirit called the world into existence by the power of his own thought. All great religions speak of a divine triunity, according to Christianity called the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The will or intention is the Father, the thought or idea the Son, and the creative power of the Father acting through the Son is the Holy Ghost. By this power the thoughts of the Father become manifest, and thus visible objective worlds are called into existence. But, said I, where does the Father find the material or substance to render these thoughts visible and objective? Within himself, answered my guide, and, looking at me as if to make sure that I understood the meaning of what he said, he continued, "Allah il Allah," says the Mohammedan, "God is God, and there is nothing beside him. He is the all, matter and motion and space, consciousness, intelligence, wisdom, spirit, substance, energy, darkness, and light. The worlds are his outspoken thoughts, but there is nothing outside of himself of which he might think, he being the all, including and penetrating everything. Thus everything exists within him, who is the life and soul of all things. In him we live and move and have our being, and without him we are nothing. Man is the god and creator of his own little world, and therefore similar processes take place when a person, by the power of introspection, directs his thoughts towards his own center of consciousness within his heart. Now this activity going towards the center could never of itself have created an external world, because the external world belongs to the periphery, and it requires a centrifugal power to call it into existence. The introspective activity of the mind is a centripetal power, and could therefore not act from the center towards the periphery. But you know that every action is followed by a reaction. The centripetal power, finding resistance at the center, returns and evolves a centrifugal activity, and this centrifugal power is called imagination. This soul energy is the medium between the center and the periphery, between spirit and matter, between the creator and his creations, between God and nature, or whatever names you may choose to give to them. The soul consciousness is the product of the centrifugal activity of the mind, put into action by the centripetal activity of the will. If these plain facts, expressed in plain language, without any scientific jargon, without circumlocutions, philosophical intricacies and modern gibberish, are comprehensible to you, all you have to do is to apply it to yourself. If you direct the power of your mind inwardly towards your center, instead of letting it fly off at a tangent, the resistance which it finds at the center will cause a reaction, and the stronger the centripetal power which you apply, the stronger will be the centrifugal power created. In other words, the stronger will your soul become, and, as she grows strong, her invisible, but nevertheless material, substance will penetrate your physical, visible body, and serve to transform it into a higher kind. Thus you may at the end become all soul, and have no gross physical body. But long before that time arrives you will be able to act upon matter by the power of your soul, to cure your own bodily ills and those of other people, and to do many wonderful things, even at distances far away from your visible form, for the activity of the soul is not limited by the circumference of the physical form, but radiates far into the sphere of the universal mind. I told Theodorus that these ideas were as yet too grand and too new to me, to be grasped immediately, but that I would attempt to remember them and to meditate about them in the future. You will do well if you do so, said the adept, and I will take care that they remain in your memory.